Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm feeling incredibly kind of like romantic today.
No, that's not like you.
I just feel kind of like I'm being swept away by dreams and like memories and washing through my brain like all my kind of past and future and everything. It's all quite intense.
Well, that sounds really deeply human.
What do you mean deeply human? Since when was this I human?
All right. It sounds really deeply android.
Thank you. I don't want to be human. How dare you? Global maybe, but not human.
Global android. Anyway, we've got an amazing guest on today, haven't we, Rob?
Yeah. And today's guest makes the most unique, sort of dreamy, beautiful, alluring paintings that to me do make me think of so many times in my life and also future times in my life that I would hope to be living.
Wow.
I just love his work.
And it's really inspiring.
I'm super
for you,
excited.
Then, Rob. Yeah.
It is very exciting. And we're speaking over the phone for the quarantine series all the way from New York. Mm-hmm. And it feels really special. So We would like to welcome Daron Langberg.
Hi, guys. I hope I can live up to this generous description.
Oh, my God. even more so. How are you today, Daron?
I'm good. Quarantined. Keeping safe. Doing home workouts and drawings on my kitchen table.
Really?
So are you able to get to the studio on any level? No, that's it now.
Not right now, no. I'm going to wait it out a little bit, but I'm definitely having studio withdrawal at the moment.
So how are you coping with that?
Getting annoyed at my husband for no reason, cooking, going on jogs.
Oh, you jog, yeah.
What are you cooking?
What are we cooking? Just like chicken tagines and we might bake bread, just things that take a long time that could occupy.
That spread out the day. Yeah,
exactly.
Chunk of your day. So you're saying you're drawing at the table. Is this you sketch a lot anyway, but you finding this as a nice way of getting over not being able to get to the studio?
Yeah, it's actually interesting because I haven't had a full-blown drawing practice in a very long time. Mm-hmm. And I really fold a lot of kind of my drawing desires into the smaller paintings that I make. So this has been kind of reliving moments in my practice from maybe even more than 10 years ago that I would really almost exclusively draw. So it's been really amazing to kind of dig into it and see what changed, what stayed the same, kind of going back to the core of my practice, which is
What has changed, what stayed the same then? What have you noticed?
Oh my God. I feel like the kind of connection between the materiality and the subject is something that is just runs through my work and really started with my drawing practice. So kind of rediscovering that in the most bare bone version of it was kind of reassuring to see that I'm still connected to that even through drawing.
Did you always draw?
I've always painted, really. I feel like painting has been the constant. And drawing, I feel like, is something that I love doing and it's really quick and accessible, but it's always been painting for me.
Right. But so the drawings now have kind of the materiality now, what you're working with. I mean, are you doing lots of, because you work a lot from life. you like to paint from life. Are you drawing your domestic scene now with you and your husband and yourself? And
well, my husband is quite resistant to being painted, so I feel like time I paint, yes, this is my fate in life.
Why? Is he just
maybe why? He wants privacy?
He's just a very private person. I mean, he does, you know, I do paint him a lot, so I have to give him credit, but every it's a process. But so this is actually interesting because, okay, I can't have models, really. So I started working from source material, like older source materials that I have.
Nice.
So these videos that I made, you know, 2009 or 2010 with like guys that like I would hook up with or something. And I'm kind of coming back to those. So it's also kind of a strange disassociative experience to like see yourself 10 years apart.
These are like home porn sex tapes that you made when you were at Yale, right?
In undergrad. Yeah.
In
yeah,
undergrad.
Yeah.
Right. Pennsylvania.
Yes, exactly. In the Pennsylvania. And then you made.
And then it was like a breakthrough eureka moment when you watched these back and you started making sketches from. Would you like pause it and make sketches from the videos?
Yeah, exactly. I would go like frame by frame and kind of choose compositions that resonated with me.
Wow. And did these subjects know that you were drawing
yes,
them afterwards?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
How did that go down? Like, were they flattered or were they worried or?
So flattered. I feel like people are surprisingly open and willing to participate in these projects. So,
and I guess there's such a distance, isn't there, between that actual, the experience you physically had and then the video of it and then painting it. It kind of all these separations in time and
yeah, do you feel distant from it, like it's not yourself anymore? Or?
Well, I feel like anytime I paint, there's like an analytical distance. Like I'm not in the experience when I'm making the work, but I feel like having had the recollection of the experience and having been there myself like allows me to access the imagery. Whereas just if I tried to paint from, you know, just pornography, that would feel like I wouldn't even know where to start.
But actually, that's quite key to what your work is. I mean, I feel like the way that you paint and the way that you use color, and that there's a real fluidity. It's a very like the minute you see one of your paintings, you know it's a Durand painting. Like,
yes.
Like you don't paint like other people at the moment. Like I feel like it's very distinctly you, even though there's this movement of figurative painting, which we've been exploring quite a lot recently on Talk Art with different artists. But there's something about the vividness, and that's kind of why in the introduction I was talking about memories and like and also like future kind of like hopeful kind of visions of what you might want your future to be, because
it's like a future nostalgia, it feels
yeah
oh wow, I love that,
which is very Dua Lipa. Dua Lipa the singer, she's got a new record called Future Nostalgia. He doesn't like that, clearly.
Oh,
Dua
really
Lipa.
I'll have to Google. Yeah,
oh, I didn't know that. Okay,
she's amazing. It just came out, it's called Future Nostalgia, and I'm listening to it all the time and I love
me.
It
She's copied me in
No, I think you copied her. You probably read it somewhere. Dua's everywhere. We love Dua.
Yes, not as much as Duron. So no. what do you think of that, Duron? What do you think of Rob's
statement? I think that for me, the paintings are kind of these emotional worlds and an externalization of what the subject is experiencing and what I'm experiencing with the subject. So I think it kind of teeters on this memory, but also this present moment. Because like you were saying, a lot of them are made from observation. So it is responsive to what's going on in front of me, but also kind of based on this long-term knowledge and experience of who these people are, what their roles are in my life, how do I feel about them. And I feel like having these two coordinates of both past and present kind of allow this projection into the future. And maybe a future where queer experiences do have more weight and do have more presence and kind of can take center stage.
Do you have rules that you set yourself for the people that you have in your paintings? Do they have to have a sort of connection to you? Or
I feel like the connection really varies. It could be like my mom, my husband, friends. Like there's just people that I have like very brief interactions with. I try to really follow my ideas, and if kind of something pops into my mind in terms of like, oh, this person would be great for this painting, or I can use this color palette or this way of painting, I just try to not not edit myself and not judge those ideas and just follow them and see what happens.
Could you paint from FaceTime? You know, like you like models in, to be in front of you. Is there anything in FaceTime if you're able to work from old like porn movies that you've made?
It's a good question. I've never tried. I feel like if this quarantine continues, I'm sure I'll dive into like the depth of despair and yeah. try to find more and more creative solutions. But yeah, I don't yeah. know.
Are there paints in your apartment or are you just able to work as drawing?
No, right now only drawing. I am considering going back to the studio and like taking my oil paints and small paintings back to my apartment. Mm-hmm. But I also am just like, I work alone, so maybe it's okay to go to my studio. I'm kind of going back and forth. But no, there's no oil paint right now.
How do you get there? Would you cycle there or would you have to get transport?
Yeah, I would probably like try to either drive or bike there because the okay. you know the subway now is like a hub, Corona hub.
God, how? I mean, is there a vibe there on the streets where people are people scared? Is it what's the vibe?
I think people are scared. Yeah, I think New York is you know right now the center of this whole mess. And it just my husband's a doctor, so I feel like I'm also getting kind of stories from the front line. And the hospitals are really ill-equipped. There's no masks, there's no ventilators, there's no beds. So even if it's more about like if you do get sick and you have to get medical care, it's not necessarily guaranteed that you would be. And I think that's what's dangerous.
There's been stories in Italy, haven't there, of people being turned away from the hospital and they're having to make these heartbreaking decisions, you know, on who gets help and who doesn't. I mean, it's shocking.
Yeah. You're part of quite a tight group of artists at the moment that are really like doing incredible work and having a massive impact, especially within like the queer circle of artists. The stories that are coming out is so present at the moment. Are you all really connected during this time right now?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was just texting with Salman yesterday and Lewis
Salman
as well.
Tour, yeah.
Jenna.
Yeah. Jenna Gribbin, lovely.
Jen Packer, yeah, we're all good friends.
And how is everyone? Is it bringing everyone closer, or is everyone fearful? Is it changing the work?
I don't know if it changes the work. I think for me, it definitely clarified. Like in a moment where we're all kind of wondering, like what's going to happen to the art world? Like when this all ends, like which galleries are going to be reopened? Mm-hmm. Are collectors going to keep buying? Like, what's going to happen to all our scheduled shows? Like, there's a lot of uncertainty in the air. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, brings up questions of like, well, who am I doing this for? Am I doing this for collectors? Am I doing this for, I don't know, Instagram followers?
Like,
yeah, exactly. And I think obviously the answer is that we're doing it for each other and we're doing it for ourselves. And it kind of clarifies just, you know, focusing on the things that are most important about the work and what drives us as artists, as opposed to kind of this inertia of the more career aspect of it.
And actually, I think your paintings have this sense of a community or friendship or kinship between you know your friends and family. And like my favorite works by you are the most recent ones of kind of group scenes, the larger works that you started to make. I think is there one called Daniel Reading?
Oh yeah, that was in my solo in the fall. Yeah, with Yossi.
Yeah, which I love. And can you talk a bit about that and the interaction between, like, compositionally, why you've decided to start doing figurative paintings with groups of people?
Well, that painting is of my husband's family, actually. And we went to visit them in Baltimore over some holiday, Memorial Day, something like that. And I brought my paints and small canvases, and I just made portraits of everyone. And I really just wanted to capture, you know, a domestic scene, a familial scene.
Yeah.
And to me, that part of the practice that's maybe more everyday, it kind of contextualizes the more explicitly queer practice and vice versa. So kind of creating a spectrum of subjects that just talks about like a life lived, right? That a queer perspective does not only have to describe things that are explicitly queer. So kind of folding in that content into like the larger narrative.
Well, the families of queer people, I mean, they're part of the experience, aren't they? Because that is your experience.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's not just about who you actually physically are sleeping with or having sex with, or you know, that kind of one part of someone's being. It's like the full experience of being
full alive. Story. Yeah, the full experience.
No, totally. And I feel, you know, like what what's queer painting, right? It's not like a queer experience doesn't necessarily, it doesn't stop in our desire or who we're with. It's how we walk around in the world, how the world perceives us, how we're perceived even like in the eyes of the state, right? Like what rights do we have and what rights do we don't have? Every moment we exist, like our relationship to our family, it's all mediated through our queerness. So it just doesn't make sense to focus on only one subject matter that's like so maybe codified as queer, but really the experience itself is much, much broader.
And I guess that's also a privilege of our time now, isn't it? Because you know, politics have moved on to a point where we aren't necessarily completely equal, but there's definitely more equality than there had been in certain cities in the world. And I think it can be, in some ways, easier to live your life as a queer person. So maybe that also feeds into the work.
Absolutely, absolutely. And also just have, like, you know, the history of queer work that's already been done and kind of what we're building on.
Who do you look at on that level? Who's your people that you're inspired by?
I feel like one of my favorites is Felix Gonzalez Torres.
Yes.
And I discovered him in undergrad, and I just, the tenderness, the intimacy, the beauty, but also like the political strategy that's folded into those works altogether is really, to me, like the kind of what I aspire to in my paintings.
Do you feel like there's a political edge to your work?
Well, I feel like that, for me, painting really represents a certain kind of empathy. And when you're looking at a work, like if you're, I don't know, thinking about someone like Van Gogh, like you're really kind of embodying who he is and his viewpoint. And when it comes to making work from a queer standpoint, I think that process becomes politicized because you're kind of having to transcend certain social or political differences. But as a viewer, you're encountering this piece as just like a human, right? So I feel like by quote unquote like humanizing a queer experience, that's a political statement. Giving it the weight that any other experience would have is a political statement.
So you were born 1985 in Israel, and growing up in Israel, you were there till what age?
21.
So what was the art scene? What is the art scene like in Israel? And what was it like then? And how did you find your way into art?
Well, I always kind of painted since I can remember. And when I was about to go to middle school, my parents helped me sign up for this art school in Israel. So really, that's when my formal education started. So middle school, high school, I was studying painting. And then I was kind of, when in Israel, you kind of have to go into military service after
compulsory.
After high school.
So you went into the military?
Yeah, yeah.
For 2 years,
I was an airplane mechanic. 3 years. I was an airplane mechanic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
What was that like?
I wouldn't repeat it. I feel like I don't think about it ever. It's 3 years of my life that I've kind of erased. I mean, it wasn't that bad, and my commanders were like really sweet and really supportive. And
didn't you actually get to paint there? I heard that you were able to kind of convince them to allow you to paint. That was really clever.
I did. Yeah. I hated being a mechanic so much that I really was trying.
And were you working on aeroplane parts?
Yeah. And I was trying, you know, I tried to like become an officer, and they wouldn't accept, just to kind of escape this work. And they wouldn't accept me. And then I was like, okay, like, I'm just gonna tell them, you know, like, I make paintings, whatever you want, like, just make me stop
me
being a mechanic.
Yeah,
exactly. And they were actually like quite responsive, and they gave me a little studio with like acrylic paints, and I painted like sunsets and like airplanes and underwater scenes and all that high kitsch stuff. Yeah.
Didn't they let you in the end paint a dormitory, your dormitory for everyone, like a mural or?
Oh yeah, that's how it started, exactly. Oh, you did your research, Russell. we had like, you know, once in a while the commanders would go around and like do like a checkup for the entire base, and every unit wants to like impress the commander. So mine was, in my unit, they asked me to like kind of decorate the dormitory with paintings, and which was very well received. So yeah.
What did you paint? Was it like propaganda like stuff or?
Well, it was funny because those first two paintings, one was of my niece with like where the base was. It's like in the north of Tel Aviv, and it's near some sort of like processing factory. So there's like this big chimney. So I painted this like kind of apocalyptic looking scene of her looking really intense and like this like chimney in the back. Mm-hmm. And actually it was defaced at some point because the other soldiers hated it so much. And then this other painting that was...
They're going to regret that in the future. They're going to be like, exactly. Shit, how did we do that? Yeah.
And the other painting was of... there's a famous photo in kind of Israeli history of when Eilat, which is like the most southern tip of Israel, was kind of quote-unquote conquered. And there's this very famous gay Israeli photographer called Adi Ness who recreated that photo about... And it's a group of soldiers basically holding a flag, but in his recreation, it was without the flag. So it's kind of this, like, the futility of war and machoism and kind of, like, you know, like a phallic symbol being, like, erected by these soldiers. Mm. So I painted that, and then the high commander and, the one in charge of the base was kind of like, why is the flag missing? Like, you need to fix that. So I don't know. I was trying to kind of...
Put
broadcast.
Your spin on it.
Yeah, I don't know how effective it was. But
so within your painting practice, you have set yourself some rules that come from the scale, basically. You've given yourself these rules within your program, right? What can we talk about that?
Yeah, definitely. So I basically make either 18 by 24 paintings, or these much larger 96 by 80 panels, and could be like two panels or one panel. And I feel like for me, I just, the way that I work is very related to what I'm painting. So it's all life size. So if I'm painting, like Rob mentioned, like that living room scene, it really is just like the size of a living room. And if it's a portrait, it will be the size of someone's like torso or head or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think like that one-to-one relationship, just gives me a lot of freedom and a lot of space to experiment with like materials and textures and colors beyond just kind of like describing the figures.
And how do you work with color? Because, I mean, if I was to describe, you know, Doron Lamberg's paintings, you would immediately probably say colorful, because you have this almost like watercolory, fluid, kind of very free use of color. Like how has that developed?
Well, it's funny because I'm not an intuitive colorist.
Right.
And it took me like so long to figure out how to use color and what it is that I even want to do with it. So when I was an undergrad, my training was very kind of skill-based. So I would look at a still life and kind of copy the colors I saw. And I didn't really think of color as a structure, something that's kind of separate from every other part of the painting in terms of that you can really play around with and make conscious decisions on and not just kind of like copy what you're seeing. So at some point in undergrad, I actually stopped working with color and just started making those drawings that I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And I was working in black
and white. They're just graphite, aren't they?
Yeah, just graphite. Yeah. Yep. Graphite on paper. Mm-hmm. And then they morphed to kind of like black and white acrylic paintings. Mm-hmm. And then only when I got to Yale, which is kind of known for its color tradition with like Joseph Albers being like a famous professor that founded like the MFA program. I was like, okay, and that, if I'm ever going to tackle color, it's going to be here. So that was kind of the beginning of it.
Didn't you get a critique from Lisa Yuskavage there while you were, when she came and looked at your work?
Oh yeah, Lisa was one of my critics when I was a first year at Yale. And you know, she's like,
love her.
Just a master colorist. And I was just beginning to work with color, like sitting on the floor of my studio with like all these like color pieces of paper and trying to figure out like how to put everything together. And she was like, I see a lot of colors, but I don't see color. And I think that statement sums up this idea that color needs to be a cohesive concept. It can't just be each bit is separate. Like you really have to think of it as a structure and not just consider each part on its own.
Wow, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. I think you refer to it as a color boot camp.
Oh my God, yeah. It really It really was, yeah.
One of the paintings that's coming to mind while we're talking about this, there's that painting, I don't know what the title is, but it's of two, like a couple in bed. And it's like this kind of blue, it's very blue. And it's almost like it becomes the sea or something in the background. Like it's got this very voluminous kind of weight to it, like the blue of the mattress. I really love that painting.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel like a lot of the work starts with two or three colors kind of initially that make up the first layer that's like usually very very loose, very gestural, a lot of times very transparent. And then I kind of try to build on top of that. So there's already, kind of from the very beginning, there's already kind of this very luminous structure.
Right.
And kind of trying to go by like, part by part, like what, how I want to create the light and the color in the painting.
And are there paintings in the history of art that you like to do with beds and things like that? Because the sheets and the kind of use of fabric or clothing in your work, I always find that's kind of why I started thinking about romance. And I didn't mean romance as in like me and another human being. I meant more like a
intimacy.
Kind of romantic gesture, you know, like this kind of idea of gestures or emotional kind of intensity or something. But I love the sheets in that painting as well.
Thank you. It's funny that you bring up romance because I feel like when I was at Yale, and even before that, like classmates and professors were like, okay, so you're like a romantic painter. And I was like, no,
oh,
I'm not.
Really?
These are not romantic. Like, what are you talking about? And I feel like, in my mind, there was like some sort of shame associated with kind of indulging in the emotionality of it and kind of the mushiness of it all. And I think that it really took me a long time to allow myself to admit it and also really dive into it. And I think that's when the work got a lot better. Like, I think when I was kind of resisting that urge and trying to pretend like, no, I'm like a really smart intellectual painter. Like, what are you talking about?
But I was going to say, to me, that they're not really mushy, though. That's because in a way, there's a difference between romance and then sentimentality or some kind of, do you know what I mean? Like, they're very distinctly different things. And I think when romance is kind of presented in a great way, it is, kind of, you know, in a more rigorous way, it's just, there's nothing more powerful than that.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm trying to, like, keep it as honest as possible and really think about what kind of experience am I trying to communicate and stick to that. And hopefully, like you're saying, that keeps it from kind of like slipping into cliche or sentimentality.
But I think it's very authentic as well. I think you hold on to that authenticity, you know, throughout by your choice of who you're painting. And I remember that painting as well. I don't know what it's called again, forgive me. But there's a painting, I think, where you've got...
I think it's just called Lovers, like every other painting that I make.
Oh, really? Yeah, is that the bed one?
Yeah.
There's another one where you painted a woman sort of with her hand on her face. And that's another one where the colours almost become... She's kind of like sitting in a very thoughtful, kind of pensive state almost.
Mm-hmm.
But the colors in that painting, like there's loads of purple on the face. And I remember when Russell sent me it, I think at one point, and I was like, it's such an unusual way to present the kind of surface of someone's skin. It's like this purple and red, and you almost feel like the light is enveloping the whole room. Like it's actually traveling in the air, like as a mist or something.
Yeah, I think that kind of, boundary crossing between the environment and the figure is something that is really important to me and kind of has been present in my work throughout in different ways. And the way, just kind of thinking of us as people as being like porous and that the outside and the inside kind of blend and one penetrates the other, I think is kind of very true to just how we exist in the world and how influenced we are by our environment, but also how much influence we have over it. Emotionally and psychically, or psychologically and not psychically. I think that kind of it's a formal way for me to think through like how we exist in the world, really.
Right.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Do you feel really emotionally connected to the paintings when you're creating them in a kind of performative way? Because I think I've read how you're quite happy for your own body to smear the paint or be involved, not just your hand and the brush.
I think that the, to me, like using oil paint is almost, it's just like a part of my body. So I think that the kind of being hypersensitive to the how a brushstroke moves, like smearing it with my hand, like you're saying, like kind of finding different ways to touch the surface is a huge part of the painting. But when I'm working, I'm really emotionally detached. And I don't, it's very much kind of like a focused analytical process of having to constantly do something and then separate myself from it and like evaluate it and then move on. And often, I mean, I feel like my husband, I'm sure, can attest, like, the paintings are quite, I mean, it's not always like a, you know, they torment me sometimes, for sure. And it could
In
be,
what
like,
way?
Pretty...
What do you mean?
Well, I feel like, especially these big ones, a lot of times they start out with a lot of excitement about the idea and these big gestures that kind of, like, you know, start the piece. And then it really is like a downward spiral most of the time. And then I have to kind of climb my way out of it. And I think I've done it enough times that I know I'll, you know, like 90% it will work out. Like I've been here before. But when you're in it, it's just, you know, you feel like you're, do I even know how to paint? Like what's going on? This is just
so it's like a constant battle with you in the canvas almost.
It feels like that, not to be like melodramatic, but yeah, it does.
And then how do you then know when it's finished? Do you just start to feel more confident in the way it's progressing?
Yeah, that actually is really easy. I feel like there's such clarity when something is done. It's just obvious. And I feel like I have, you know, like text group with friends, and I would always like send them pictures like, is this finished? Is this finished? Do you think now it's finished? And it's the answer is always no, because if it's finished, I know it's finished. And they have the, you know, the unpleasant job of being like, well, like, what about the left corner? And it's like, oh. So I feel like but when it's done, it's almost like a machine that you turn it on. Like everything works, everything flows, like it makes sense. Like nothing is kind of jumps out at you as being problematic. So it's quite a clear experience, actually.
Can we talk about your dick pics, your dick portraits?
Yeah. Yes.
So aside from having portraits on the smaller scale of people figuration than the group scenes or the bigger canvases, you also have a whole series of works where you paint penises of a lot of people. How did that come about? How do you get these subjects? And how does this factor into the rest of your practice?
Well, I think a lot of the subjects are friends. So it's people that, you know, I can paint someone's face and I can paint someone's dick, and it's kind of coming up in the same process of kind of this like immediate circle of friends and people that are close to me. Mm-hmm. And the idea started with someone sent me like a dick pic, and I was like, I want to paint that. Like that would be a great
painting.
That was
painting. Your first thought of it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, this is a great painting.
That's a very healthy response to a dick pic. That's very nice, yeah.
And he was just, you know, he was very sweet, and he was like, yeah, sounds exciting. And I did that for my first solo. I had like a series of like three or four of those. And it was both dicks and assholes. And
what was the response to that?
Well, I think the gallerist was very supportive, but I think that definitely some people were kind of hesitant of, it was in Laurie's side, like, you know, like, do we really want to have these, like, super explicit paintings, like, hanging? I think in the end, it really just, it turned into such a part of my practice that now I can't imagine it not being part of the dialogue. I think, to me, just the explicit work really, again, it's something that I've been doing since I started kind of dealing with this subject matter, but also it really is a meeting point of the gap between kind of how I experience my sexuality and then how it's experienced publicly.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Do you find it exposing, though, when you first showed them? Do you still see them as super intimate? And at that time, did you find it quite exposing for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me, they're both everyday and very intimate and very explicit. Like, they're all those things at the same time, which I think is what makes them kind of unique within the practice, that they really fold in this, maybe, you know, for someone who's not necessarily used to or part of kind of like seeing these kind of imagery or experiencing these kind of things, like it could be like upfronting and something that will like push them away or be viewed as like very explicit or even gross. Whereas I think for me, it's something that I experience as like beautiful and tender and intimate, and even to be in that situation. Like, for example, I painted for the group show that I had at Periton. It was a series of paintings of my friends hooking up. So even just being there in that moment and like sharing that with them was such an intense, beautiful experience. Whereas I think for someone who's maybe not queer or like, it would, you know, like a painting of like two guys rimming would be like something that completely, like, they would reject.
And a lot of your subjects, your portraits, the smaller scale, end up being blown up into the bigger scale canvases. Do you ever work, like, do these penis pictures ever get blown up to a bigger scale, or the arsehole pictures?
Yeah, so the paintings that I mentioned that I showed at Periton were kind of the basis for like the big rimming painting that I had later in the show that I had in the fall.
Right.
So it's not that they're blown up per se, it's just they are part of the bigger painting.
I was going to say, because the body, the scale of the body is still the same to represent one-to-one to a real human body,
but
the scenery around it might become bigger. So the room would expand almost.
Yeah, it's like you kind of are zooming out.
And I heard that family-wise, when you were growing up, you had much older siblings, and then you were the youngest. And was art something for you that, because I imagine you must have like grown up in the household as the only child, no?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So do you think art became something for you to sort of escape, like, I don't know, I don't want to project too much onto your experience, but what was it like growing up, like, as an only child, but with older siblings?
It was amazing, actually, because my parents had a lot of time and resources, and they were just, like, really supportive. They loved having, like, an artist child.
You were the only artist in the family, no?
My mom wouldn't say that she's an artist, but she's an artist. She's an incredible weaver, and she used to draw when she was younger. Yeah, so I think that I definitely feel connected to her in that sense. And she was never really encouraged to pursue art, so I think that she felt that it was her duty to encourage me as much as possible.
She's still in Israel?
Yeah, my parents are in Israel.
Do they ever come over and see your shows here in New York? Or?
They do, yeah. My mom and my niece actually came to see my show in the fall, which was really, really fun.
Wow. You've also had amazing advice from lots of other incredible, like, proud, out, queer artists. And I think you had one from Michelena Thomas who gave you another, like, groundbreaking sort of
tip. Yeah, Michelena, it's funny because when I was an undergrad, I went to Norfolk, which is the Yale summer program for juniors. Mm-hmm. And it was right after I started making these small drawings from the sex videos. And in my mind, they were all, you know, I was a figurative painter. These are figures, and they're doing what figures do. I didn't even think of it in terms of kind of like a queer context or even a sexual context. And when I got to Norfolk, that was kind of like the most immediate response that I got. It's like, what are you even, like, why are you talking to me about like light and dark and composition and like pencil like lines? Like, these are guys fucking, like, can we address this? Mm-hmm. And I think I was really just not ready to take on what it means to be a queer artist. Like, what am I supposed to do with that? Like, am I now a voice for a community? Like, I just, and Nicolene was one of the visiting artists. And I loved her work from before. And they were just so, such empowering, beautiful works that both felt spoke to like much larger themes, but connected so deeply to her personal life. I was kind of asking her, like, where do you take like the nerve or like the bravery to kind of take on these themes and be a voice for these issues? And she really just told me to follow my experiences and that I don't have to worry about it kind of having to be like a voice for other people. It's really just my voice and my experience. And that was extremely liberating and very helpful.
Yeah, it kind of takes the pressure off you. It's almost like otherwise you're going to be carrying around this constant pressure, which would probably paralyze you and make you maybe not even be able to make work. I mean, if you feel the responsibility of the world on your shoulders, it's like actually the personal, you know, is enough to protect that in a way.
I just think for so many young artists, like this idea of like working from a marginalized viewpoint, it's like, oh, I don't want to be like a queer artist because that's limiting. I just want to be an artist.
Yes.
So I think that kind of letting go of that and understanding that that's an illusion. Like if you're not, there's no, neutrality doesn't exist. Like if everyone's coming from a particular viewpoint, everyone has a certain experience and the work is just and kind of saturated with that, whether you acknowledge it or not. So there's nothing more or less, the only limitation of working from a queer place is the limitation that society imposes on queer experiences, but not your own. Your own experiences are not limited.
Mm-hmm. I think we had this conversation when I came to visit you in your studio in Times Square when I was rehearsing Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, literally like two blocks away from your studio. So after rehearsals one day, I came along with Patsy Foran, who was playing Honey in the play. Hi, Patsy. And we came along to your studio. And I think at that time, there was a painting which I'd seen in a group show, which you had at Boetsky Gallery, which was a massive scale work set in Fire Island with four figures in it. And I remember talking to you about the time about like ghosts and how it felt like these figures in there that you hardly ever paint. I don't think you've ever painted anyone face on. They're always kind of furtive, looking away, but waiting for you to notice them rather than looking for your attention. And it has this work, your work plays with this kind of like past and present. So you don't know exactly where you are, even though you set it in parenthesis Fire Island. You don't exactly know that it's there because it has this passing quality of all the characters, and I think I've connected to it so much because it feels like it does make me think of the AIDS epidemic. It does make me think of the past, our past, like the people whose shoulders we're standing on now and able to, and like Angels in America and The Normal Heart and The Inheritance. These stories, I feel like your narrative, it just connects with me so much.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think that I remember that studio visit, which was so fun. Thank you for coming.
Of course. I'm so jealous that you got to meet Patsy because I've never met her. And now
she's so cool.
Because you're not doing the show. And I love her. I think she's incredible.
I know, it's so sad. Mm-hmm. No, but I think that thinking about, you know, I'm Jewish and my dad is a Holocaust survivor. And he lost most of his family in the Holocaust. Yeah, he was actually born during the war, so he was like a baby. Yeah, it's a crazy story where his mom hid him in a monastery, and she hid in some attic, and then escaped him, and then they walked to like a refugee. It's like all these, you know, every person who survives, there's like crazy, crazy stories.
Oh my God.
So I think that the kind of this realization, or not realization, this acknowledgement that everything can be taken away at any moment was just very present growing up. And that kind of anxiety. And I think that's something that queer people share as well, right? Like you mentioned, like the AIDS epidemic. That like in a heartbeat, like everything can be everything can change. Everything can just
and also,
like the ground
I think
beneath
there's a trauma, isn't there, that continues through future generations. So like people that survived the Holocaust, their children can have a sense of trauma too, and then their children can have a sense of trauma. Or, you know, it can be to do with how people don't necessarily open up about something. So maybe they're trying to act strong, or, you know, so it kind of does continue.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think that my mom is actually just writing a book about the Holocaust. I mean, her family didn't experience it, but kind of, I think, her experience with my dad. And she's a psychologist, so she's kind of writing about this, the nature of testimony and how does one know the Holocaust? Like, what's truth? How is it communicated? And we were talking about the introduction to her book, and I was kind of just brainstorming. And this idea that, like, you can know nothing, right, and still be a product of the Holocaust, like you're saying. It's like this inherited trauma. But I think also for me, this kind of framework, like growing up in that with this knowledge, and then also like being gay and kind of inheriting this history, again, really makes you focus on what are the things that are most important to you? What are the things that are dearest to you that you want to talk about? And I think that, like Russell was saying, like these histories, these personal relationships, these connections to other people through like friendship and sex and intimacy and familial relationships, that's what sustains us, and that's the true meaning. So I think that kind of like creating these scenes where people are described in a way that is as full as I could, like as much meaning I can cast into them in terms of like having a sense of past and present and future, and creating these narratives that are...
you do all in one. It's amazing. It just plays with time. It feels like you're just there. What is time? You're kind of traversing everything because of the scale as well. You can get lost in it. It's like, it makes me also think of like the lilies, Monet's lilies, you know what I mean? When the big ones surround the room, you don't know where you are, but you're kind of immersed in this experience. Your paintings are an experience.
I mean, yeah, those lilies at the MoMA are just, that's one of my favorite rooms for sure.
Yes,
it's just like you can't even look at it. It's just, you have to walk. You have to walk and see it, and like you just experience this like very subtle color change.
It washes over you, doesn't it?
It's stunning, yeah.
Yeah.
So how important is nature to you? Because some of the paintings also have this incredible intense connection to nature and trees and kind of like, you know, wider landscapes.
Totally. I think that for me, I feel like I don't have access to landscape or nature unless it's mediated through a human experience. So when I was in Berlin and hanging out like with a friend, like on those lakes that like so many queer people were around, and it almost felt like this, like queer heaven. So I made a bunch of paintings kind of set in that situation, or the meat rack in the Fire Island that you guys mentioned, where it's basically like a cruising ground. So kind of having the landscape itself be sexualized, or like a potential for desire. And that to me is kind of a catalyst to making the work. Or even like, I mean, I was just, not to get like super heavy or whatever, but I just recently, one of my, a close family member passed away, and I was in Israel for the Shiva. And my brothers and I were kind of hiking near my home in Israel. And we came about this like beautiful field of red flowers. And those were also kind of the flowers that we like put on the grave. And these to me are the connections that I'm looking for, or that inspire work that's related to nature, kind of as they interface with us and our experiences and our emotional worlds.
Well, everything is rooted autobiographically, isn't it? Everything, all your connections, it's like it's your life, it's your narrative.
Yeah, and the hope is that like through that, like not necessarily that people would have to know this whole story I just told, but that the maybe sense of like loss or kind of a eulogistic sense would be communicated in the painting itself. And the story or the biography is just my way of accessing that, or being able to kind of put that in material form.
Right. Wow, I love it. I love it. So we ask every guest that comes on two important, very, very important questions, very testing, which you know of, but we also put in a Brucey bonus at the minute because of we're all in lockdown.
He won't know what a Brucey bonus is. A Brucey bonus is a guy called Bruce Forsyth, who was like a British TV presenter, and he used to have this really hilarious weekend TV show that was very popular. Millions of people used to watch it.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Rob.
They used to give you like a bonus prize, a Brucey bonus.
The Brucey bonus.
And also, we have more American listeners now, so I mean, we need to...
This is just your bonus, your Big B bonus.
It's funny because I prepared for the questions because I've obviously like have listened to the podcast many times, and I was like, okay, I'm not going to be one of those guests that don't have an answer, but now I am.
Yeah, well, let's see.
People always get there in the end.
We might not be. So the first question we ask everyone is, if you could do an art heist, if you could steal any work of art in the world legally and live with it and keep it, what would it be and why?
So I'm obsessed with Bonnard, which I feel like is just apparent through my paintings.
Yes.
And there's one amazing one at the Met that I keep coming back to, which is the terrace at Vernonnet, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. And it's like a really big, beautiful painting. That to me, I mean, what's so special about Bonnard is that he captures this like light that's only possible in painting, and I think that painting really like exemplifies that beautifully.
Didn't you once try and make a painting using all of Pierre Bonnard's color palette?
What a mistake. Yeah, I mean, because he uses every single color in every painting, and when I did that at the time, I was just like using like a very limited palette, and I think I came out of that exercise being like, wow, he's just such a master. But I should probably try that again. I feel like now I'm a little bit more confident, so maybe.
Who else are your influences then?
I love Kitai, Vuillard, yes. Velasquez. So many. I mean, obviously contemporary. I think that when people ask that question, the real answer is really just my friends. Many of them. Like we were saying, like Lewis and Salman and Jen Packer that I'm obsessed with.
Yes.
My friend Sarah Fox, Julia Bland. There's just so many kind of people who are just close friends whose work has inspired me and influenced me like over the years. So
it does feel like such a magical, exciting time, doesn't it? I mean, it's like, you know, Russell's been incredibly connected to it as well and has kind of got me into that group of artists. And I'm really happy that it's happening while we're all here because it does feel really, really exciting that somehow paintings are going to this new place or something.
Mm.
Definitely.
The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color?
So there's this one pigment that I use called Crimson Lake.
That's Crimson like a, Lake?
Yes. So it's
sounds
a transparent
very
pigment.
Sensual. Very sensual.
It's like a, it's a warm red. And most of the reds, most of the red pigments that are transparent are cool. So like alizarin and magenta. And this is kind of the only one that I found that was almost like cadmium red, but transparent. And I'm obsessed. Like every painting starts with that color. So that's basically that's definitely my favorite one. Yeah.
Nice. I've got to look out for that in all of them though. So the other question we've asked now, which has come up, is what is your hidden lockdown talent? A talent that you've discovered you've had, which you didn't know since you've been in lockdown?
Well, I discovered that I'm a pretty good administrator, actually, which I've never tried. Because I'm
what
trying...
What does that mean? In what way? In what administration?
Well, like organizing things.
Organizing things, yeah. I'm trying to get this auction / sale off the ground
yes.
to benefit the food bank for New York City, just to kind of alleviate some of the, you know, hardship
low
that
income,
people are going
yeah.
through. Yeah, they really outreach elderly people, homeless people, kind of the people that are most in need in this crisis. So kind of sitting at home making drawings, I was like, I'm sure everyone is sitting at home making drawings. Like, how about we donate some and make kind of a donation? And the response has been like so amazing. And, you know, right now I'm just like trying to wade through the red tape of like tax questions and like auction house schedules. And so I've discovered that that's something that's possible.
When are you going to do this? And how are you going to, try and go through like an online auction thing, or are you going to try, and when you hope
to
achieve this?
Yeah, the goal is to do, Yeah, the goal is to do an online auction. And really, in the next few days, I should figure out exactly when it's going to happen. But just as soon as we possibly can. That's kind
of. And you actually emailed me, and we're giving a Catherine Bernhardt work. Yeah, and I must say your administration skills are very impressive because.
Thank you.
You convinced Catherine and myself immediately.
I can't wait, sis. It's going to be all of your friends, all of the people we're fans of, are all going to be taking part.
All my incredible friends and just really people that I reached out to Instagram that like happened to follow me and we've never really like communicated, but are like amazing famous artists and almost everyone was just so generous. I'm really so blown away by the
I can't kind of wait to see this sale.
Yeah, me too. Hopefully it happens. You know, I don't want to talk it up and then it'd be a
failure. It will happen.
We'll help make it happen.
Thank you. Definitely. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, and I'm really proud that Catherine's going to be part of it as well, because I think
me too. It's such a game changer for us. Yeah,
amazing.
It's the same actually in the UK. We've been supporting Trussell Trust, who are a food bank charity.
Yes,
and they help food banks across the UK in different towns, because obviously every town has its own food bank, so it's a big pressure at the moment that's on them.
Definitely. And yeah, I shouldn't take full credit for the idea, because this is something that a lot of artists are kind of doing right now, even on Instagram. So there's an artist, Hannah Bierman, who's really incredible, and she started this Instagram account called Artists for Humans. So she's doing it on a much more kind of like immediate, like posting a piece, selling a piece, donating the money, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, I love it. And I'm sure there'll be lots more. And the great thing about all these initiatives is that they inspire other people to do something. You know, it's like...
Exactly.
You know, one person hears about it and then gets connected and then they have an idea. Exactly. And I think that's what's going to be such a beautiful thing about this is...
That's what happens.
Looking out for each other, yeah.
Yeah, seeing that like my friends, like a friend of mine was donating and I was like, oh my God, like we should just organize something like really big and make it happen. So it was very inspiring.
Awesome.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Doran, I'm going to end so on great a, to speak on a, to you.
A,
yeah,
quote
you
that
too.
You had.
Thank you, guys.
There was a quote that you had that says, as you are painting, you are creating bonds with the history of painting.
Yes, I believe that deeply.
And the future of painting, surely.
Yeah.
And the future of painting, yes, hopefully. That's the goal, right?
Incredible. So everybody listening, all the images we've been talking about will come up on our Instagram at Toolcart. And Doran, are you on Instagram?
I am. It's just Doran Lingberg, my name.
Amazing. And
so we will connect to you on our Instagram when this episode comes out. And thank you so much for being part of our remote recording of the quarantine, quarantine.
Thank you for being a beam of light in my quarantine.
Oh, well, you've been a beam of light to us for so long.
Ditto.
Now I've actually got to speak to you for the first time. I'm so happy in person. Well, not in person, but you know what
me
I mean.
Me too.
We're communicating at the same time.
Yes. In person soon.
In person soon, yeah. Well, lots of love and thank you so much and all the best for that auction. It's such a wonderful cause. And
thank you, guys.
Very soon.
Big love to Ron. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diament and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.